now. Smokes and smokes and folks in Mexico. Baked by the sun almost every time I go to Mexico. And I'm willing. And I've been kicked by the wind, rocked by the sleet, had my head stowed in, but I'm still on my feet and I'm willing. The light bulb went out in the hall. Things have gone to pieces since you left me.
So now I'm in an installation by Terry Allen, and it's a wire cage about 20 foot square with barbed wire all around it. At one end, which is where the music is coming from, there's a sort of a tableau of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs and a neon statement saying there it is. And walking around the wire cage, it's rather like a bar in mid-America with Coke cans in sand and a neon sign in the window. There's a bust of President Kennedy in the window of this little cafe, and a cross, and a little Buddha, and the American flag, and other triggers to do with American myths and traces of American popular history, sentimental examples of American history, and some Indian paintings on the outside of the building. Well, now I'm sitting next to Jemana Chaland here in Kassel, and first of all, I'd like to ask you, Jemana, what do you think of the Documenta so far?
I think it's a house without window, which means there's no vision outside. And it's kind of a very compressed show, and it's kind of flat and banal. I don't know why, but because, you know, it's a very interesting moment today to show, you know, two political possibilities if they want to be political. One is the most interesting work, especially in the States now, are from movement artists. They are really poorly represented here, except, you know, the incredible work by Jenny Holtz or Barbara Kruger or Marie LaFontaine, you know, a few pieces. And I think that, you know, they had a kind of theoretical background, but they didn't achieve, you know, one way is to write with words, and one way is to write with a show, which is another kind of writing. And I think they have no, I call, choreography. They don't know how to kind of establish certain elements of interpretation of the show. It's a very confused and melting. You know, you don't see what is the main idea, or, you know, one or the main street of the show. It's kind of very confused, very a kind of flat tire for me. And that's the feeling of the show, is that you enter in one space and it's a gallery space, and it's a kind of repetition of, you know, Marion Goodman, Mary Boone, Metro Picture. Also, the architecture is very effective against the show because they completely close the building. And there's not, you know, the opera of Fridericiano, you know, the kind of operatic architecture is gone, and what you find is just a repetition of gallery space, which I think has nothing to do with doing this kind of special show. It's a kind of fair, you know. That's my first reaction. The second reaction is, if you have to do Documenta every 5 years, it has to be an exceptional event.
Yeah.
So that's what the exceptional part is missing. Something that you know, something that doesn't give you an interpretation about what is going on today, because everybody's traveling, knows whatever is around. So they have to, whatever will be the next, to consider that Soho is a better documenter every day. It's not every 5 years, because you have all this work together in one block. So that's kind of competition in the world has to be considered. And not for Europe, but, you know, if you are international, you have to go and to consider that. So you have all the same artists in one day in New York. So that's Missing Surprise is about that.
So you don't think that one of the primary argument about the show, or of the show, which is the idea of art that has some social function and social placement and the relationship between how it's received in a social context, you don't think that the show here expresses that?
At all, because, you know, to do that, you have to have a project in mind. It's the idea of the project that is missing. What I was trying to say, there is no main street. Means, you know, the idea of the society, art and society is very important, and I've been fighting for years, but the idea of putting in the same building architecture and art is interesting if you make them collaborate. It's not to show architect as art or art as architecture that makes the connection. When I proposed for this documentary, my team, that was the jam session of the arts, was to ask people to work together for giving a project, which is, I don't know what kind of project, actually I have to work with them, and to make them to work together, because, you know, the architect knows about urban planning, the artist knows about visual, or advertising, or whatever. So, in fact, you know, the best work is by Barbara Kruger is using advertising against, you know, the vision of today. You know, we don't need another hero, or I shop, there I am, is an incredible piece, because deals with consumerism, and, you know, you can work with these people on this level of projecting some idea for the society, but you have to commission, as you commission an architect a building.
Right, right. And you were a candidate for being the curator for this.
Yeah, that was my proposal, but, you know, I think they misunderstood, because my team was Anseline, Baudrillard, Federico Fellini, and myself, and Katharina Smith. But the idea was not to bring all the things together just as a banal, you know, kind of show of creativity, but to work for a project. That's what I think Art for Society is about. You know, you work for a specific project, as I did for Oldenburg, Frangieri, Kosher van Bruggen, you know, in Venice. Or I'm doing, you know, with Rebecca Horn, doing a film and doing shows and collaborating. You know, this idea is not to do anything to do with decorating the city as here. You know, you have to do something as exceptional, and that's the occasion. Yeah. Otherwise, it's just another show.
Yeah.
And I think this documentary is just another show, which is kind of flat.
We're back at the Orangerie now. It's a wet afternoon, but talking to Bill Woodrow. Bill, we've just been in to look at your installation, and it's extremely hot in there, so we've come back out. I mean, what generally do you think about Documentary 8 and your place within it?
I'm still trying to figure out exactly what my place in it is. I'm a little clearer about the concept of the whole show now than I was when I first came, but I'm still not clear exactly what it is by any means. I just have some notions of, well, I can see what the installations are, and I'm sort of figuring out.
How do you feel about the sort of juxtaposition with some sort of design pieces or designed interiors?
That's one of the things I'm still coming to terms with. It's not something that initially bothers me, because on one level I don't mind what is next to my own work, which is basically what the question is about. You know, do you mind what's next to your work? I don't mind. Unless it's something that really intrudes sort of physically upon it or something. But, and in the case of these, the design things, I think it's an interesting idea. I don't know whether it's come off.
Right.
I'm still formulating that. A little swamped by it all, I think.
Right. I mean, one thing that I was interested in, when you were invited to participate in this documentary, I mean, were you aware of this theme that they've developed, or argument about the idea of a social role and placement of art and design?
No, not really, because I was invited, and I was asked if I would make a large work for the documentary, and a sort of a large room-sized installation, you know, like, and I was asked if it would be sort of like another work that I'd made, in the sort of the concept of it taking up the whole space and the kinds of things it used, which I thought was a bit strange to be asked to do something, you know, like another work. So I decided I wasn't going to do that, but I'd still be in the show. So I said, sure, I'll do it. But I did come back and look at the space in February, and decided that I would make one sort of large work that would fit into a quite big space. And I had no idea what it would be or what it, you know, anything at that point, and I didn't know what the work would be until really I started making it, you know, what, a month and a half ago or something. And as for the, you know, going back to the previous question, the whole concept of the show, I didn't have any notion of that when making the work. I mean, the sculpture was... I made it in the same way as I make anything else I make, just purely for myself. And with the restrictions of knowing or hoping that I would get the kind of space that I knew about.
Mm. Well, perhaps we could finish by, you know, talking about the work, which I believe is called The Lure of Civilization. Well, I suppose the starting point is a, you know, what one sees in there, which are three harps that seem to be semi-constructed in a sort of a bronzed sheet material, and semi-deconstructed also, with a number of items such as a crocodile and a sort of flowers and what's over the third one?
It's a microphone stand.
Yeah, I should have remembered that. And sort of inverted bowl shapes on the ground with a piece kind of cut out of them. I mean, it actually fragments the space quite considerably, doesn't it? I mean, the space becomes quite tricky to walk through, so it interferes with the passage of people.
The whole sculpture is made from, I think, approximately 13 copper hot water cylinders, using this sort of sheet material of the cylinder, and then the base and the tops to make the bowls that are like lamps, like oil lamps on the ground. And the three harps are well, I would just call them in a state of decay, in a slight state of decay. I mean, the whole thing has, I think the whole sculpture has this sort of air of decay. Nothing is, the microphone isn't connected up. The harps aren't playing music. They have a few strings. The crocodile is dead, sort of just limply arched over the middle harp. And the wheat, is the bundle of wheat is in a way lies between the two, because it's something that we actually use as a sort of produce, in the sense that it's cut. So it's dead, but it also has some optimism about it because it can be made into something else. And generally, the whole sort of atmosphere when I was making the work turned into a very sort of monumental, sort of a shrine-like.
Yes, that's. I got that sort of archaeological tomb-like sense.
Yes, with all these sort of little lamps that are just sort of lighting up. In a way, I can't be more eloquent than that, because I didn't have a set idea about what the work was about before I actually started out on the thing. I mean, the initial idea was to make a harp, and that turned into three harps because I liked very much the first one, and I wanted then this sort of repetitive motif. And then this kind of the decaying aspect came in, and then the whole work sort of developed from that.
Yes,
there are some themes in it in terms of the imagery and the ideas that seem to be fairly consistent with the kinds of things you've treated over the years. Mm-hmm. The idea of the microphone on the stand and mm-hmm. as a kind of metaphor for communication and mass communication is there and has been throughout the 80s. Mm-hmm. And also just the idea of music as being some kind of medium which mm-hmm. is employed in that kind of communication. But also there is what seems to me something which connects this with some of the other recent work of yours I've seen, which is a much more overt statement of ecological concerns and social concerns. Mm-hmm. Would you think that's a fair statement?
Yeah, I think that's quite a fair statement. I'm thinking, just in terms of the images that are used, I think they're in the areas in which they are, they're like the microphone for sort of communication and power, and the animal for sort of natural systems, and then the wheat as food, and the harps. For me, actually, they're quite interesting because they have a. Although they're a contemporary instrument, they have a very strong image of history for me. Mm. I mean, I'm not quite... I know where images of harps come from, and right back through to sort of Greek mythology or something. But they're not specific. They just have this very strong image of time in them, which I liked very much. And the lamps seem to kind of fit with that in a way.
Yes, I mean, it is that sense of time that I get from that installation.
Mm.
As opposed to some contemporary material that's actually been altered or changed or reconstituted.
Mm-hmm. And the microphone, I think, is important because that brings it up to date. I mean, and so it puts the present into the past, in a sense.
Well, this is the evening of the first day in Kassel at Documenta 8. I'm sitting next to Elaine King. Elaine, you have some views about Documenta. What do you think about it so far? Because you've been here 2 days and you've come from the United States yesterday.
Well, I'm going to go back tomorrow and look again with a more scrutinous eye. My first response the first day was more skeptical and negative because the work seemed somewhat superficial. However, after examining both pavilions today, stronger pieces are surfacing.
Which pieces do you think are the strong pieces?
I think Richard Archfeiger is very strong in the show. I think Leon Golub, Jenny Holzer, Gerhard Merz. I've looked twice now at John Armleader. Sarah is very strong. The juxtaposition of Sarah in the grand foyer and with the haka below, I think, is very strong impact. Also, I liked that having the formal work of Sarah's and then the more political statement of haka. However, beyond that, I think installation is the great travesty at Documenta. There seems to have been no care or no attention paid to the installation. Case in point is the work room that Richard Archfeiger's work is in with Sia Armanjani. It becomes very confusing. It becomes very distracting. And it seems unfair to both artists, who are strong artists. And I think that's unfair to both of them. And I question who allowed this to happen. Being a curator myself, I think it's critical to pay a lot of attention to installation because that makes and breaks the work of art ultimately. And also installation plays a large part in conveying the message of the artist.
Right. What about the argument or theme of the show about art that seems to function more in a social context? I mean, do you think that that argument rings true in the exhibition you see here?
No. I think also there's a contradiction with that. I think today at the press conference, the curators were saying that there is no idea, there is no social context. And a friend of mine who heard the entire press conference was saying that the curators are claiming there is none. At the same time, the surfaces as a concern. I think the fact that there's a denial and there's an ambivalence perhaps is evident in this show because the show, to me, has a veneer quality. It doesn't have the substance of fine wood. It's like a stage design purporting to be architecture with no foundation.
What about the design and architectural elements of the show, which are quite new in a way in terms of a documentary?
Well, I like the idea of incorporating design in architecture because I think design and architecture and the breakdown of the idea of craft and furniture of the last 10 years has become part of the art scene and the social fabric. I'm not convinced on the choices. I'm not convinced on the display. The other thing that seems to be problematic with the work is there is such a thrust towards finding meaning and content, and there's also a leaning towards being, I feel, cool, trying to have a cooler approach to the art, leaning towards, you're seeing evidences of leaning towards a more conceptual base, leaning a lot towards structural concerns, leaning towards the architectonic, be that in the sculptural or in the actual design. Maquettes, plans, wall plans. But I find for myself a sense of being derivative. There's a derivative, there's a pastiche quality, there's a conglomerate type of quality. Now, I'm not that familiar with some of the names, and that's what I'm going to do tomorrow. That's why I cannot quote the exact names of specific artists to you, because some of the German artists and the Dutch artists included here, I'm not familiar with, just to quote them to you right now. And so I must go back through the show and look at the specific works and make some notes in references to the pieces. But to me, there was this pastiche quality and a derivative quality. And I question why curators would be picking pieces that were so blatantly derivative of, let's say, late 60s and early 70s artists.
I wondered if that was because of the way the works were installed and the nature of the works, rather than the works themselves. Because if you divide up a huge space into little cubicles and put an aspect of one artist's work there against another aspect of another artist's work there, you do get a sense of just sampling the work.
Well, yes, that's true. I don't think you have enough work to go into depth. However, let's look at a juxtaposition of, we all know the work of Daniel Buren, and then you have the work of Gerhard Merz. Now, there's a difference in the concerns and the ideology, yet there's a relationship dealing with the incorporation of the interior space and the environmental interior and the formal qualities. Yet, I question for myself the impact. You know, is there a stronger impact with the purity of Daniel Buren versus the kind of synthesis of content and formalist issues in Merz? And that was one of the questions I raised for myself in going through the show.
So what will you do tomorrow then? Because this is what, your last day tomorrow? Or will you have another day?
Well, I may stay another day. I don't know. I'm going to go back again and look again. And
right.
The fact that I have been responding to some things negatively gives me cause to question myself and to grapple again, to have an argument with yourself and have an argument with what is presented.
Right. Well, I mean, here we are sitting in the middle of Kassel in West Germany, and you're from Pittsburgh. I mean, have you come to perhaps select artists that you might want to show in your gallery in the university?
I'm always looking, always looking.
Is it just really to keep abreast of things going on in Europe or what?
I think it's imperative to be an American curator to see firsthand what's going on in Europe. It's imperative to talk to Europeans. It's imperative to see a selection of work by a more European-dominated committee, to see the concerns, to see the pieces. You're never going to get that from media.
Right. And will you make any exhibitions with artists that you have seen here, do you think?
There's a possibility.
Yeah.
There's a possibility to make exhibitions, and there's a possibility of writing about it or at least making a direct, informed reference. I really believe that you cannot depend on media, and I really believe if you're trying to be active, you must make that effort to come to as many of the international displays that are housed.
Right. Is there any individual artist? This may be very difficult. I mean, you'll be going back to your gallery in Pittsburgh, and I mean, are there any artists, or is there an artist that you've seen, or the work of an artist you've seen that you would be interested in terms of an exhibition?
Well, there are a few artists whose works I would like to definitely go back to. I'm not certain of their names. For instance, the room with the linoleum and the printing press, I was very attracted to and felt that there was more depth there. I don't remember. It's a woman artist.
I think it's Liz Magor.
Yes, I believe that's true. Yes, I was interested in her work. Another room that interested me was the work of a man who was originally from Italy and now lives in Munich. The name is something like Piliazzi. It's the room at the top. It's a red painted staircase, and then they had the videotapes with the water and marble slabs against the wall. Do you remember who that was? Plessio, I believe it's Plessio, is the Italian man from Munich, who is originally from Italy. And I found the entire environment, the use of space, the use of the audio, the use of the video, and then a certain kind of mysterious ambience. I really did find that worthwhile spending time there. I'd like to know more about him, and if the situation would arise to allow the man to do a site-specific piece, I think it would be worthwhile.
Well, I actually have a recording of that piece, and just to describe it, one went up a staircase, into a darkened area, and there was a lot of noise, a lot of sound, and one saw a circle of video monitors set at about 3 feet from the ground with water on, rushing water, and in the middle of the space there was a conveyor belt moving up, and in fact the sound was very strong, very strident, and the space was darkened, and there were slabs of marble lent up against the wall, and the recording that we're hearing now, in fact, is that space.
And it was an artist who understood the elements of the visual, of the perceptual, and the idea of the unknown. I think he really allowed enough for your imagination then to enter the piece. And it was the juxtaposition of the various elements that made that piece work. Plus, it was alone, and plus you had to enter the piece. You had to climb the stairs. You had to enter a dark space. You had to allow yourself to experience the audio sound, which changed, because sometimes the water would disappear and sometimes the video monitors would go dark, and so you would not see the rushing water. And so the idea of the cadence helped to accent the piece. And so he was another artist. A piece particularly that I found to be arresting and a successful inversion was Nam June Paik's piece with the performance of Joseph Beuys. We are all familiar with Nam June Paik's work, so you enter the room and you immediately say, ah, Beuys. I mean, you say, excuse me. You immediately identify it as Paik. And then within minutes or seconds, you notice that the performance is Beuys. Now, a lot of us will not sit through an entire video piece. We'll stay for a while. But there was a hook here because it was Beuys. You became, I felt, seduced by it. And even though on the mini screens you had this marvelous graphic effect and you had this dissolved and various type of drawing, my eye kept centering on the center. And it was a very interesting thing because it's an homage to Beuys. And while you knew it was Paik's piece, ultimately Beuys dominated. And we all know Beuys is dead. But the spirit and power of Beuys dominated the piece. His sounds, his gestures, his body presence. And while it was Paik's piece, it ultimately became Beuys. And that was marvelous.